interpersonal relationships affect political movements and our activism? What can we learn from Native American traditions to restore ecological balance? How can transforming capitalism help address global inequality and the environmental crisis?
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
For me, this book has a lot of the wisdom of things that feminists and queers have learned in community about sexuality, but the book is really for anybody who's political. Even just starting out, just beginning to be like, oh, there's something wrong with the systems I live under. I want to be in movements. Our movements are made of relationships. So if you're just getting into our movements, or if you've been here for years and been watching the ways we hurt each other and fall apart relationally, this book is about what are these common patterns? How do we stop thinking it's just us, or it's just an individual problem, or it's just that other person, and instead be like, oh, these are just really common patterns. There is so much we can't control that's terrifying and heartbreaking right now, right? So we all are seeing every day the headlines out of Gaza, the headlines about the ecological crisis, the fear of what the next Trump presidency will bring. And we've been living this way for a long, long time, far before the recent election, right? We are also all under enormous pressure, general global pressure and our specific lives. And we might be hard on each other, right? We might flake or ghost. We might be bossy to each other. I'm hoping that this last election was truly the death knell of liberalism and the Democratic Party for a lot more people. I mean, they're obviously who they've always been, but it was so naked. That liberalism is a project about remaining invested in the current genocidal, ecocidal systems, and that it has nothing to offer us. They are lined up with immigration enforcement. They don't give a fuck about queer and trans people or reproductive justice. They're 100% behind these horrible wars, including the genocide in Gaza. I just hope we can all truly turn away from that towards what is needed, because it really takes away a lot of people's energy. This is a hard moment, and I'm not interested in any false hope. I'm interested in us being like, wow, it's a really hard moment. Okay, we are motivated to get it together with each other and be really bold and brave and really caring towards each other and really discerning about what is a waste of time in terms of trying to convince elites to rescue us. Like, it's just not going to happen. So I feel like this moment is clarifying, hopefully mobilizing. Certainly a lot of people are filled with a lot of anxiety. I feel like one of the best solutions to that fear is to join with others. Get out of it being a single experience with just me and my phone and the doom scrolling, and get towards being with others, feeling the grief and the fear, and choosing to do something pragmatic right away.
I just finished a semester at Union Theological Seminary in New York, and graduate and postgrad students, they either were angry or sad or just in shock after years of study that they've never heard the Native history as we know it. We've always been overrun with Western historical domination as they see it, that they came here for benevolence. They brought us civilization. They brought us cars and tech, all these things. It was the ships that came while we stood on the shore watching the ships come, welcoming, abundance, giving. And then they came and they took what we offered, but they took more. And that's where we're at. And now we're seeing a whole abandonment of spirit and put into the ideas of a dogmatic soul. When I approach these peoples in these educational institutions, I often come with those two perspectives, knowing that Native people also are forgetting our own perspective and mimicking Western educational process.
One of the reasons that we get to do so many different things is because every time they get out of their patrol car, anything can happen. Because that's true for cops. Like, they don't know from one minute to the next what's going to happen when they show up. Is it going to be funny? Is it going to be scary? Is it going to be overwhelming? All those kind of things. And so it gives us a lot of ability to tell different stories about policing. I created the show in the shadow of the murder of Philando Castile, who was a Black man who was pulled over. And if you remember that horrible video, you never actually saw the cop that came up to his car. But you heard the fear in his voice. And that fear had nothing to do with the man in the car. It had to do with what he brought with him, right, on that traffic stop. My sort of idealistic idea coming in to The Rookie was, let me see about creating a show where we can be aspirational, right? Where cops can do the job the right way. There's a moment in the pilot where there's a man who shut down Hollywood Boulevard. He's having a mental episode. He's waving a bat around standing on a car. And police officers often shoot people in mental distress, especially ones who are armed. So because Nathan's character, John Nolan, spoke to him, he realized that the guy was having a mental breakdown, partly because he had parked his car with his young child in it and couldn't remember where he parked. And so we saved the kid because we talked to the guy. We always tried to talk about things during the show, unfair sentencing laws and stuff like that, and also how cops deal with it. Obviously, after the murder of George Floyd, we had a bit of a come to Jesus internally about the show. I actually asked a few writers to go give us a report card on how we had done in the first two seasons in terms of policing issues. And for the most part, we had done well. There was a few instances where a cop celebrated getting a no-knock warrant, which basically means the cops can kick your door in without identifying themselves. But it did feel like we had created a version of policing which was alien to a lot of people. That's not their experience, right? Not everybody's always happy to see the police when they show up for a variety of reasons. So we really leaned into, starting in season three, like, how do we talk about injustice in the justice system? And how do we keep that issue alive when the spotlight that landed after George Floyd's murder goes away? Because, of course, we all know that they burn bright and then it mostly, sadly, goes back to the status quo. So I'm like, I want to still be talking about this year, next year. And so we still try very much to be conscious of the issues around policing when we create these cases.
I think writers of color are always dealing with something other than writing, and it's not fair that we have to think about the future of our writing or what the eyes of this or that person versus the eyes of this or that person might say. I have never been interested in doing any writing that would somehow throw off the fact that I was a Black writer. I've never been interested in getting rid of the fact of being a Black writer. I've never been insulted by being called a Black writer, and I've never been insulted by being included in an anthology of Black writing. I think there's a fear about that because people will say, well, if you do that, that becomes all you are. And my frustration with that statement is twofold. One, what's wrong with being Black? As if Black is not expansive, as if Black is not all-encompassing, as if George Washington Carver was not Black. This idea of all you are that can come even from the mouth of an aspiring Black writer really is a sentiment that we inherit from whiteness. Black is all you are doesn't come from Black people. That's my first trouble with that. And then my second trouble is, no matter what you do, it doesn't matter anyway. If you're a Black writer, if you're a woman writer, if you're a Bangladeshi American writer, that is what you are. And you might write something that people think of as something that, I hate to use this word because I don't believe in it, but people like to say that it transcends that thing, as if that thing is so low. Let's get on top of it. But in truth, everyone will still think of you that way. Nobody ever thinks that I'm not Black. After the Pulitzer Prize, I was still Black. And I love that. I'm so glad I'm Black. Like, why wouldn't I want you to know? Why would it be a secret? It's not a secret. I mean, when you read my writing and it's clear that you're reading the work of a Black writer, I don't feel somehow betrayed by that clarity. One of the things I say to them is that our job as writers is to write what will become cliches. Not to write cliches, but to be original enough that we make something that people are still saying, that we say the thing that characterizes thought on a subject for hundreds of years to come. And if that's what you're doing, that's pretty powerful. You're in a position of power. I have to understand what I'm doing when I'm doing it. It feels like it to me. What I'm doing when I'm writing a poem is making a world. And if I can stick to that, then I have to believe that once a poem is out in the world, another world has been made. Another way of living, another way of thinking, another way of seeing things. One single poem is a way of seeing things. If I believe that, I mean, I'm saying stuff like that all the time, but if I believe that and I'm a person who made the damn poem, I'm a person of power.
I think part of what motivates this book, as I'm sure you all know, the person most likely to hurt you or kill you is your romantic partner. Romantic relationships are incredibly dangerous. A third of people in our society are in domestic violence relationships, and even more than that are just in something that's stiltifying, or where they don't get to be their full self, or where they don't get to have their interests, or they're miserable in some way because of the conditions of this relationship. And so to me, this question of, if we want liberation there, how do we free ourselves of some of the mythologies that set up this isolation that makes us be like, I have to be all out just for this person, and therefore, oh, I can't be with my friends anymore, or I have to move to this place where this person is moving. Like, we kind of just lose a sense of how to keep our full lives going. And it's okay to be so moved by love and sex and to be dizzy with it and to be so hot for somebody and even have fantasies, like to feel like I want to be possessed by them or possess them. And you can find ways to play with that stuff instead of actually doing it. You know what I mean? Like, how can we enjoy some of the ways that those things are pleasurable without actually signing up for the most extreme forms of isolation and controlling others and being controlled and believing my safety is wedded to being able to control others?
a report came out in 2022 as a recap on limits to growth, a 50-year sort of anniversary report. And in that, we suggest transformations that involve eliminating poverty, reducing inequalities, empowering women, changing the food system, and changing the energy system. We articulate the roles for businesses, for corporations, for governments, for consumers, for all the stakeholders that will be required to act. It is not the responsibility of just one sector. This has to be done together, and it has to be done in a collaborative way. And if we put an antagonistic lens that it is billionaires versus the poor, we are not likely to find a solution that easily. So we look for something in which each party can respectfully understand each other's positions and move towards that optimum solution that will be good for all. The inequalities that have been created over the last 100 years have distorted even the principles of capitalism as it was originally conceived. Capitalism is not one thing. It has been around for 500 years. And over that time, you and I and the public have given it certain rights to do certain things in certain ways. They're all legal rights. They've just accumulated them to a point that in the United States, a corporation is a person, and a person who has more rights than all the human rights that we have. So it is in our interest and it is our responsibility to reshape the rules of capitalism and to make sure that it both reduces the extreme inequalities as well as allows the development of a healthy planet, that it doesn't extract the life system out of a healthy planet. Can that be done? Are there good ideas for doing it? My answer to that is yes. In the last 50 to 75 years, we have learned so much about the nature of what's going on to Earth systems as a whole, whether they're mountains or forests or oceans or land masses. So we have tremendous amount of scientific knowledge. We have also a political understanding of the downsides of this extreme inequality and the advent of climate change because of the way we are utilizing our resources. So I think the science is clear. Now, we also understand that there are barriers to change because the current system benefits some people, privileges some ideas, and it's taken 500 years to evolve. It's not going to change in the next year or two or five or 10. It's a transformation process that we need to put into place.
We hope you've enjoyed this program. To hear more from these guests, listen to their full interviews. These interviews were conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. This episode was produced by Mia Funk and Tom Logan. Associate Interviews producer was Jamie Lammers. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.